Thank you for coming. I'm Nicole, and I'm going to be talking about how can I forgive myself. And this is a topic I'm not very good at personally, which is why I chose it to try and share and learn more about. I've been practicing Buddhism for over 20 years, but I mostly find myself practicing the wisdom part of it, the clear seeing, and I've practiced a lot of metta, but mostly I practice in terms of compassion towards others. So having compassion towards others, being kinder to others, understanding others. And even though if you've ever done meditation, a large part of it is on sending this love to yourself. I have never been able to do that very well. And so when it comes to that part, it's sort of just hollow words. I repeat the words, but I don't feel the same softness and love and compassion that I am able to feel when I consider a friend or even an enemy or someone else. So I've done that for a long time. I thought that, you know, self-love probably isn't all that important. Why, you know, as long as I'm nice to other people and I'm wise to my own thoughts and I can be in the present moment relatively well, I just didn't understand why self-love, I don't know. I didn't understand why it was important. But I wrote down notes. I'm trying to follow my notes this time. But they always talk about Buddhism as being, you know, wisdom and compassion are the two sides of Buddhism. And it's like a bird that flies and it needs both wings. So one wing is compassion and one wing is wisdom. And I've heard that a lot. I just didn't understand the full part of compassion. But I think part of it was, I've lived in a lot of environments in my life with family and other people I've lived with that were not really safe or supportive. And I felt that it was easier in those situations to not have a lot of love for myself because it's a vulnerable feeling. And it's really when I do start to have compassion for myself, if you're in a situation that's not safe or not supportive, it's sort of, for me anyway, makes me feel sort of more open and vulnerable to what the other people are doing. And so for me, it seemed unsafe. But now I'm in a relationship that's very loving and very good and healthy. And I've found, to my surprise, that I have a lot of trouble letting that love in. And so when my partner Tyler tells me he loves me, I feel almost paranoid about it. Like this part of me comes up that is just almost on guard. Like, well, I believe him, but I think that he only loves me because he doesn't know me well enough. And there's that sense of if he really knew me, then he wouldn't feel this way about me. And I've noticed that more and more as we've been together for more time. And so now there's a part of me that really wants to be able to enjoy that love and to feel happy and to feel it. But there's this barrier. So anyway, so that's what brought me to this topic, and in my life and in this talk. And I chose the talk to make it important for me to study it more, to make it a little bit more pressure. Since I have to talk about it, I better learn about it. So I've been doing that. So one thing that I noticed with myself, and maybe you guys should try it now, is that when I do the meta meditation, there's a part of it where the practice is to turn to myself and say, I forgive you, to myself. And so, if I want to just take 1 minute and just say, I forgive you, to you, you can say your name. So for me, I forgive you, Nicole. And if you just say that to yourself a couple times, and see how that feels. Now, for myself, I'm doing a little better with it now, but I noticed that I forgive you for myself, it just sort of ricochets off my heart. It doesn't really settle in. And that was, when I noticed that, it was very interesting to me, very curious. And so I started to wonder what it was that made me feel like I was not forgivable. And so a lot of what I'm going to talk about tonight is from a book called Radical Acceptance by Tara Brach. And just because a lot of what she said really made sense to me, and so I hope it made sense to you. And that also, because I always think that I'm just abnormal. And so when I read the book, Radical Acceptance, it was helpful because she described me to a T. So now I know it's not just me. It's apparently everybody, I guess. But one thing she said was that the belief that we are deficient and unworthy makes it difficult to trust that we are truly loved. And so when I read that, I knew that I had trouble trusting that I was really loved, but I didn't really understand why. And so then when she says we are deficient, the belief that we are deficient and unworthy, I realized that's true, that that's what blocks the love. As soon as I feel love, I feel this part of me come up that just says that this isn't right, that this, I'm not worthy of this, that I'm not the great person, that whoever it is that says they love me thinks I am. And so all this unworthiness. And so I started to examine where this deep sense of unworthiness comes from for me. And like I said, that the book showed that everyone has it, but for me, I really could see being disabled. I've been disabled since birth, and it's a really hard life in this society in terms of value, because most of our society devalues people with disabilities just off the bat. It almost goes without saying. And even the language is very devaluing, like invalid, it just means invalid person. And a lot of the words are negative, like defective and whatnot. But this is considered normal, and it's also considered normal that people would rather die than be disabled. It's almost cliche for people to say, I'd rather die than be in a wheelchair or have to have help with this or that. And I was born that way, so I never walked and I didn't know any different. It just was my way of life. But obviously I was always treated differently and put into different categories of human. which is almost not human. So things are a little better now, but 42 years ago when I was born, it was pretty bad. And I was born at a time when it was getting better, so it's a sad state. But I could see that in me, and I could see that that was like my basis. You know, when my mom found out that I was disabled, she was afraid and very upset. And obviously, it wasn't what she wanted, and she didn't want me as a result. And so it started very early, and so I can see that, and I can understand that. And so as I started to look into kind of what blocks my heart from feeling love, it seemed like that was sort of the foundation of it, at least. So as I was reading Radical Acceptance, Tara Brach talks about everyone having this. And so everyone has a different life experience, but apparently everyone has this feeling of not sure if they belong in the world, and not sure where they fit in, and not sure if they're adequate people, and always comparing themselves to someone else and feeling inferior and wanting to, try to measure up and never really feeling satisfied that they do. Apparently that's very common. So she calls this the trance of unworthiness. And I'm just going to read her description of it because it's really a very good description. So she says, when we are in the trance and caught up in our stories and fears about how we might fail, we are living in a waking dream that completely defines and delimits our experience of life. The rest of the world is merely a backdrop as we struggle to get somewhere, to be a better person, to accomplish, to avoid making mistakes. As in a dream, we take our stories to be the truth, a compelling reality, and they consume most of our attention. While we eat lunch or drive home from work, while we talk to our partners or read to our children at night, we continue to replay our worries and plans. Inherent in the trance is the belief that no matter how hard we try, we are always in some way falling short. And so when I read that, I was like, wow, that's cool. I feel that way too. And but I really noticed like how I almost never just feel content. There's always some part of me that's always this striving to make myself better, a better person in my work, in my job that I do, my interactions with others. I always push myself physically farther than I should, and I try to accomplish more than, just more than whatever I do. And so, but underneath all of this, it's like almost every moment of my life is this need to prove that I'm worthy of being alive. And I really see that that's sort of a motivational force in my life. So Tara Brach goes on to say, feeling unworthy goes hand in hand with feeling separate from others, separate from life. If we are defective, how can we possibly belong? It's a vicious cycle. The more deficient we feel, the more separate and vulnerable we feel. Underneath our fear of being flawed is a more primal fear that something is wrong with life, that something bad is going to happen. Our reaction to this fear is to feel blame, even hatred, toward whatever we consider the source of the problem, ourselves, others, or life itself. So I really related to that. obviously with my disability, I have a lot of issues with feeling that I don't belong or that I'm deficient or that something's wrong with me. And, you know, there's the society value, it really values beauty and physical strength, which I don't have. And so all of this sort of makes me feel not equal. Also, there's the idea of being useful and being able to be useful and active physically and active in activities and to help, you know, just everything is very physically based in this world, which you might not notice so much unless you start to have a physical problem. And then all of a sudden you can see where you end up. It's just kind of on the sidelines. So I have this this sense that I don't belong. Also, I was a poster child when I was a child, and you know, it was a very negative experience, but I remember they had a, you know, they were trying to raise money for a cure for my disability, and so one of the tactics was to have a picture of a healthy child running, playing, you know, with other children, and this really good scene at the park, and then underneath it, it said, we want this, with that picture. And then a picture of me, and sort of like, just in my wheelchair, not, I don't know, just sitting there. I wasn't frowning or anything, but I was sitting there. But underneath my picture, it said, not this. And so, you know, and then the whole idea was, you know, to raise money to prevent people from turning out like me. And it's, you know, that's just a really clear message that I received at that time. But it's like that with everyone, that we have ideals of what everyone's supposed to be. And if you're not that, then you're not what you're supposed to be. And so I started thinking about this, remember these things, and I can understand how that motivates me to try and always do more and be better and find some way to make up for myself. I also notice that as I have more physical problems and my body weakens, I really do feel a sort of hatred or blame towards my body. So if it has a problem, I just, you know, my initial reaction isn't, oh, how can I take care of my body? It's more, oh, now what, you know? Or, now what do I have to deal with? Or now what do I need help with? Or I just get really angry. And that's the initial sort of reaction, is just to reject a physical problem. Also, the different deformities in my body are ways it doesn't look the way it should. I really have a lot of hatred towards that as well, because on some level, like the small mind part of me, I really feel like that's what makes me not worthy of love. And so then I feel a lot of hatred towards that part that I think is standing in the way of love. However, I do have really good love and really am the problem, but anyways. And then the other area that when I read that passage reminded me of was mental pain. And so when I have anxiety or post-traumatic stress symptoms and other reactions or depression, it's the same response. As I don't have patience towards myself, I think I should be over it, or I should be this way, or I shouldn't have this problem, or I should know better. And especially with Buddhist wisdom that I've practiced and know very well in philosophy, it's really easy to recite the philosophy and understand it and understand where the pain's coming from, the way free from pain through meditation or present moment or opening to a different perspective. But the pain's still there. And so then there's a real part of me that says, you should know, that you know this is just ego, or this is just, you know, confusion or delusion. It's like when you can really name the places of where the pain comes from, it really helps for that clear seeing, but it makes it really difficult, for me anyway, to bring the compassion side in. Because then I feel I'm harder on myself. You turn my page. So then just noticing these things and how really with the wisdom teachings of Buddhism and being able to understand them and being for me to be able to be clear about them, I still have to remember to engage my heart in the teachings, and that's a really important step that for some reason I miss. And so I've been noticing that, and trying to spend more time cultivating that side and the heart side of things. And so one thing that helps me engage the heart is to just sort of to notice this the level of cruelty that my mind inflicts on me, and that the mind inflicts on others. It's often easier, of course, for me to see it in others, and I do see it a lot in the work I do. People are really hard on themselves, and from my perspective, I can see that and have compassion for them. One thing that really helps me to see this and opens my heart up is that when I see people have lost a loved one, lost a child, or lost a spouse or something, they more often than not blame themselves in some way for that loss. And so they'll feel guilty either that they should have done something they didn't do, or should have known something they didn't know, or else just that they didn't do enough, that they should have been there more. And there's the past of, you know, I wasn't there on that one day when they wanted me there, I wasn't there. And that's where the mind goes. It's so, it's interesting, but it's sad to see it, but it happens all the time. And it's a wonder when I see it in others, it's a wonder because to me I can see that they just love that person and they lost that person. And isn't that a sad thing? But for other people, it always somehow that pain seems like it has to, or it just has this tendency to turn around back on us. And I do it too. I mean, definitely, when something happens, I immediately the mind has some reaction that blames myself for it. And so seeing that, I just feel that it's almost impossible to not feel compassion. And then in the ways I talk about seeing my own self-hatred with how I blame myself for if I get sick or if I do something, you know, I feel like I'm a bad person if something bad happens to me. And there's really that automatic mind that thinks that way. But then there's something else that sees that and notices that that's just very, very cruel. So being able to see that cruelty, it just sort of has started to cultivate my heart, because then it's really hard to stay mad at myself if I see how cruel that blame is. So yeah, as I've been working on this and starting to see this stuff more and more, my own trance of unworthiness becomes more conscious, so it begins to lose some of its power. Because the reason it's a trance is that it's unconscious. It just happens, and I don't even know it's happening. And when it's in that state, then I'm powerless to do anything. But if I can see it, then I'm not in a trance anymore, and then I can feel, I can feel the compassion start. And it's not like I didn't see all these things before, but it's interesting because, with Buddhism, there's a lot of teaching about the ego and the ego self, the small self, which I know about, and I've known all of these things and attributed them to ego. But the problem is that in the trance of unworthiness, even the wisdom teachings can be turned into self-torture, because then it would be mad at myself for having ego still. So I was always like, well, why do I still have this ego and this ego problem and this small mind and all of these emotions and, all the stuff that I shouldn't have anymore. And so I don't know, for me, I just noticed that I do that with the ego. It's like ego's a bad word and something that you shouldn't have or shouldn't be. So from there I went to trying to have more of a understanding of this small mind idea that, there's always someone talking to me in my head. And obviously there's someone else that's responding. And, it's a funny thing when you start to really look at the mind, the way it talks to itself, and I take it so personal. So for me, it's like, there's a part of me that's always commentating on me, you're bad at this, don't better not do this, I wouldn't do this if I were you. Who is that that's saying all of this? It's just a funny thing, because is it me? Or who's doing it? It's sort of schizophrenic in a sense of all the different personalities in my head and all the different people telling me what they think I should do. And it's all me, and it's just, it's really interesting. So I started to think about that small mind, and I remember when I was about 5 or 6 years old, and I first realized that there was someone in my head talking to me all the time. And I first heard that voice, and I realized, who is that? And so I asked myself in my mind, is this me? Who's talking? And then that voice that said, is this me? Said, no, that's not you, this is me. And then another voice said, no, that's not you, this is you. Well, no, this is me, and this is me. And it just went on forever. And it was never ending. I sat there for, it seemed like a long time. I was pretty young, who knows? But it just went on and on, and there was no end. And I could tell that I was never getting to the source of who I was. There was always another voice. No, that's not really you, this is you. And so I went on and on like that. I really thought I would reach the end, and that there would be someone that was me in there. But I didn't find that person. So I sat there doing that, and I remember at some point finally realizing that there's this quiet place that all this is happening inside of. Like there's this expansive place that's watching. And maybe that's me. But that part doesn't talk. And so it's harder to have conversations with it. It's just there. It's just quiet. It's accepting. It's like all listening, all giving, all caring, all embracing. And it just has no boundaries. And I could feel that part, and I do. And now I understand that that's Buddha nature. And that's who we are, really. But this is the heart, and this is the quiet, subtle parts of ourselves that really needs us to meditate or to have quiet time in order to even recognize. Because it's not that loud voice, it's not that the one that we hear bossing us around all the time. And so I've been really trying to remember that that is my real self, and all these other judging, criticizing, unforgiving selves are not, you know, they're just the mind, the small, afraid mind. So, and I also notice when I pay attention to the heart or to the Buddha nature side that when my mind tells me everything is impossible, that I can't possibly do this or that, or, you know, that I'll never be the person I want to be, the heart always thinks that it is possible. And that's the part that just keeps me going on the spiritual path and trying, even though there's definitely times where the mind says, you might as well just watch TV and just give up, because it's not, you're not making progress. But that's just a judging mind. And so I'm appreciating that quality of the heart that just really believes everything is possible, and has a certain supportive strength behind that that keeps me going. And I also know that the heart is more powerful than the mind. And I know this because I've worked with people who are dying and worked with people after people have died. And I know that in this process, you know, of dying, that there's this letting go of everything that's not important. And when it finally gets to the point where people have let go of everything, and I've been very close to death before too, so I've done it myself. It's just a certain narrowing of priorities. And then when you get down to it, the only thing left is love and the people that you love and wanting to be with the people that you love. And that's the only thing that matters. Actually, none of your accomplishments really matter all that much on your deathbed. It's more important that you have peaceful, loving relationships, or that you feel peaceful in yourself. So, and I had this sort of reminder lately because I had a lump in my breast and I didn't know what it was. And I realized that, you know, I was worried about dying. But then when I was worried about it, I was worried about all the stress and the medical ordeals that I'd have to go through and all the fighting I'd have to do and, you know, all the people that I would let down if I were to die, and just all this stuff. And then all of a sudden I thought about with animals. With animals, I have a lot of animals. And I have a I don't like to put them through a lot of medical ordeals if they're sick and they're dying. And, you know, I treat them to a reasonable degree, but I euthanize them. And to me, I thought, what if I could just, you know, euthanize and not have to go through all of the sickness and pain and all the fighting and the medical ordeals, but just live until we decide it's time to go. And then all of a sudden I felt that a lot more relaxed, and I all of a sudden had a different perspective on life, and just in the moment that I had that thought, thinking that if I decided to do that, then I could be sick, and nothing would be wrong with it. It would just be the process of, you know, this is the end of my life. And so I would be finishing things, and then I would be, you know, maybe, trying to teach people whatever I'm going through, or help others, or just being with Tyler and other people that are important to me. And it's like, it felt so much peace to just think I wouldn't have to prove myself. I wouldn't have to accomplish anything else. I could wind down. I could just be in my life and not try and be better or get somewhere in the future or accomplish anymore. And it was just a really, really big relief. But I'm not dying, I don't have cancer. So I'm still here trying to accomplish. But it was really a moment where I felt like I could be sick and tired and confused, and it would all be okay, because it would just be understood that I'm doing the best I can, and that would be done for that. It was just such a relief to have that thought. So the last thing I wanted to talk about was that the fear of imperfection. And so there's a Zen teacher that, Dogen, that says, imagine what it would be like to live without fear of imperfection. And I read that, and I realized that imperfection is not a personal problem. It's just a natural part of being alive, and it's very normal for all of us to want to be perfect, want to be the best that we can be. It's our society, it's a slogan for a lot of stuff. And it's really easy to get caught in the wants and fears, and but when we can relax to this feeling of imperfection being okay, it just relieves so much tension from life. And then, all of a sudden, it's like you can just, or I felt that I could just be alive and actually feel being alive and not trying to be in pursuit of something different, but just being alive. This is who I am. I'm imperfect. And that's okay. And that's still, to me, just kind of an amazing thought, but trying to live that way a little more, because it's so much of my life, I notice, is wasted in fear of not being good enough and not being perfect, and so that fear just stops me from feeling a lot of life and being actually here, because I'm just worried about, am I doing a good job? So I don't know, but to me, Buddhism is a funny thing, because, you know, I've been hearing the same things over and over and over, and I always think I understand it. But then all of a sudden one day, like 20-some years later, I hear the same thing that I've heard a million times. But this time, I finally understand it. And that's kind of what's happening to me with this process. is I've heard the words, but they were just words to me. And, words of heaven. Try not to be judgmental and have mercy on the unkind mind. And, allowing things to just be as they are. You know, they're words, they're great words, and I thought I understood them, but now I feel like I'm understanding them on a deeper level. And trying to move beyond wisdom, but say, I really see how wisdom by itself is hard to bear. As you see all of this, I see all this in myself, and then say, well, now what do I do with it? And I see all my tendencies, my habits, my areas where I'm being selfish, but then what? If the compassion doesn't start, then that wisdom can really be hard to live with. And so, recognizing the beliefs that sustain this trance of unworthiness is the beginning of freedom. And that's what I've been working on. Just saying it so that you know that's just the trance of unworthiness. And then I can step out of it, because then there's no reason necessarily. It's not necessarily true. It's just unkindness. So if you guys want to, there's a few exercises that were in this book that just I was going to share with you. Probably just briefly, that will help you recognize your own trance of unworthiness. And the first one's very, very simple. It's that often we perceive the trance most clearly by recognizing how we want others to see us and what we don't want them to see. So if you bring to mind someone you've spent time with recently, someone you like and respect, but you don't know very well, what do you want most for this person to see and think about you? What do you not want that person to see or perceive about you? And then the other thing that I brought, this is a lot of questions to ask yourself, but I had all of them, so I decided to read all of them for you guys. Hopefully you won't have all of them like I did, but maybe it will help you recognize some of the areas where you're hard on yourself. So if you can just pause for a few minutes to consider the parts that you habitually reject and push away. One is, do I accept my body as it is? Do I blame myself when I get sick? Do I feel I'm not attractive enough? Do I judge myself for being too heavy, underweight, not physically fit? Or am I just dissatisfied with how my hair looks? Do I accept my mind as it is? Do I judge myself for not being intelligent enough, humorous enough, interesting enough? Am I critical of myself for having obsessive thoughts, for having a repetitive, boring mind? Am I ashamed of myself for having bad thoughts, mean, judgmental, lusty, or greedy thoughts? Do I consider myself a bad meditator because my mind is so busy? Is it okay for me to feel insecure and vulnerable? Or do I condemn myself for getting depressed or anxious? Am I ashamed of feeling jealous? Am I critical of myself for being impatient, irritable, and tolerant? Do I feel that my anger or anxiety is a sign that I'm not a good person? Do I hate myself when I act in a self-centered or hurtful way? Am I ashamed of my outbursts of anger? Do I feel disgusted with myself because of ways I behave or partake in addictive behavior? Do I feel that because I am selfish and often do not put others first, I am not spiritually evolved? Do I feel as if I am always falling short in how I relate to my family and friends? Do I feel something is wrong with me because I am not capable of intimacy? Am I down on myself for not accomplishing enough, for not standing out or being special in my work? That was a few of her questions. She actually had a lot more. So, anyway, I just wanted to stop there and open it up and see if anybody wants to share any thoughts that they have about this for yourselves, or if you have any questions, I can try to answer them. Is there anything that you want to share?
There's a moment when I really felt the connected to, and that was when you talked about the heart and hope. And I realized that one of the changes in my life over the years has been to see hope. Even I see a great deal of hope in myself and other people, even though I think the human race is that I don't think we're going to last that long.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that the time that we have, we can't have hope. That we can have hope in each other and ourselves. And so that's one of the things that's changed for me, is that I can be happy even though I don't think the human race is going to last forever.
Thank you.
It relates to a lot of what you talked about. The feelings of I'm not good enough have been really present for me lately. I was in my aunt, from New Jersey originally, and I just spent 5 weeks in a treatment center for eating disorder, and realize that I've been stirring around a lot of the same old stuff for a long time, and I'm not good enough. That book, Radical Acceptance, mm-hmm. is wonderful, and it really, what I've been struggling with lately is I'm involved in all of these different coping methods and passion, and how do I live with myself, and what are good coping mechanisms, and how do I not destroy myself for not being perfect. And I had a conversation with somebody when I was in Oregon at the treatment center about, you know, I don't know what the right way is to meditate. I don't know what the right way is to do it. How should I do it best? And I was talking to her about this, and she listened and she smiled. She's like, you know what you're saying, right? And the thing that I've come to realize is it's okay. It's okay to not have it all figured out. And I mean, like, I'm so used to taking tests and trying to prove myself, and in reality, it's all just one big test. And if you, I learned to say about taking pressure off, a lot of the times I pretend that it's just a dress rehearsal. So, if I pretend, you know, this isn't, I don't have to figure it all out right now, I don't have to look this way or be this way or act this way, because I'm just figuring it out right now, and I have my entire life to prove myself. Whatever. A big thing about eating disorder is giving up this unreal myth of that losing weight will make you happy, mm-hmm. and that being perfect will make you happy. And what's my purpose if my purpose is losing weight or being thin or fitting in? And I realize my purpose is just to live my life. Might as well enjoy it. Right. So, really, two things that you enjoy that feed your soul self, I think, are the most important. And I've talked a lot about this with my aunt. And, just when you're your authentic self, it's not hard to bring other people to you. And I think it's hard to be forgiving to ourselves, but when you're just true to who you are, maybe through that process, mm-hmm. it seems like you get closer to forgiving yourself. I really, really appreciate what you're sharing.
Thank you. I think it's really, it really helps me, like, when I hear you talk, to just, feel compassion for you, because the, you know, our whole society is set up that everything is a test, you know, for all of us. And really from the time we're born, like, we have to fit into the developmental stages and everything has to be normal and, you know, and of course above normal is great. And it's just, there's so much pressure everywhere to be better. And it's nice, you know, some of the Buddhist traditions that we were watching a little talk of the Dalai Lama today, and just the idea of the monks and not wanting, like, part of their practice is to not be special, just everyone's equal. And it's not a goal that one person's more attractive or wears better clothes or is more intelligent in this way and that. And even the Dalai Lama is always saying he's just a monk, you know, he's just a regular monk. And it's really interesting to compare that with our society, which is so much about competition and being the best. The best according to what someone says is good. Which I don't know if that would be good. Anyway, thank you.
One of the things that you said early on, Nicole, about how you used to feel that if anyone really knew you, they would love you. And it just reminded me of early on in my relationship person who since became my husband, I just had this belief about, you know, if he ever really knew me, how he would really love me, and how I thought that the whole for years, thousands of dollars in therapy. were all about, I thought that, we just really had to struggle with everything. Was a struggle to be ruthlessly honest. When I think about how unkind that behavior was to myself and this other person, now it just shocks me. But I really thought that was the way things should be, was just constant struggle, and an authentic person was ruthlessly honest, all this emphasis on the ruthlessness, and how my practice has really changed that so much, and instead of that to really see kindness and compassion and the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much more important. And I think because I'm so much older now than I was then, that, in my 60s, I just, the grip of things is not so tight. I think that so many possibilities that in my 30s, 40s, even my 50s were still there. They're just kind of not there on the horizon anymore. And that sense of that, the sense of self is a really different self, being much older and in a kind of cohort now that probably isn't valued as much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the forgiveness practice, I think much more of how we inevitably harm one another. We inevitably harm ourselves, and how we're all just kind of in that together. And that the most important thing is the compassionate heart and the kind heart, and that just seems just the place to rest. The wisdom is really important, but the kind of striving that goes on in looking for that clarity or that really understand the punishing aspects of that too. So I really thank you for articulating that.
Yeah.
Really reminded me talking. I did that. I probably still do it now because I get worried about being a Dharma fraud. I don't sit enough. There's the whole list. But, when I'm in my state of place, there's not that much suffering. The suffering is much less.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's been good to realize that lately, because I have been, like I said, in a lot of environments where it isn't the ruthless honesty. Or it might not even be honest, but ruthless. And when there's that going on around me, then I notice that, really opening the heart is not really possible. I hate to say it that way, because it probably is, but it's not possible. It wasn't possible for me. I opened my heart as much as I could, but I definitely had to keep certain parts shut. And so it really, really helps to have a safe environment and, where you can be imperfect and it's not going to be, you're not going to be beat up for it. And that's such an important aspect. Which is why I really love the common ground, because, people here are really trying to be authentic and not perfect. And that's great.
The speech that you gave was
very good. And I would like to know if you're going to have a transcript of it or a recording of it so we can study it, read it.
Yeah, I think that it was recorded. Yeah, it was recorded, and I think they put it on their website. So if you go to the Common Ground website under Dharma Talks or Audio Dharma, something like that. Do you know what it's?
I'm not sure.
When you go on the homepage of the website, there's an icon on the right that's like a person sitting with headphones on. If you click on that, it'll give you the list.
Okay, we'll
should be. I don't know when.
I don't know how long it takes for them to put them up. It depends who's putting them up and what else they've got going on. But it shouldn't be too long.
I said we gave a talk here. It was about 2 days. And it was already on there. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
So whoever's listening to this right now, you have 2 days.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, so now you have 6 p.m.
So, thank you. Yes.
How do you handle it? I was listening to what you said, and it's very good. How do you handle those times when you have real negative feelings and thoughts about yourself? That's the part I wanted. I didn't quite get that. I know it's a huge question.
Yeah. It depends. You know, sometimes if they're really intense, then I just feel miserable for a while. But I have felt miserable a lot in my life. So I do have a certain trust in that it will pass. And so I try to just feel miserable and not freak out about that part of it. And then eventually, when I'm able to have more perspective, what happens is if something happens, if I'm judged or criticized or feel that I am in a certain way that just touches that nerve, you know, and just brings to life all of the other sufferings I've had, then that can be like re-experiencing my whole life of suffering in 1 hour or whatever, 1 moment. And so when that happens, I don't always know how to respond right away. I usually just wait, and I wait for sort of the clouds to clear enough where I can start to talk to other people about it and sort of share what's happening for me, which that may take a day or two. And then once I can share it, start to process it, and just have this trust and this faith that, that understanding what happened is all this got triggered, and that's not necessarily true. And so that's where it really helps to see these things. For me, it helps to see where all these feelings come from. And then be able to have that discerning mind that says, okay, but is that really true? Is that really what I believe? You know, am I really not a worthy person because I need help with everything that I do?
Does compassion for yourself also include accepting that you will at times have negative feelings about your situation? Yeah. So that is that part of being compassionate?
Yes, definitely, I feel. I feel like there's that mind, you know, the small mind, the ego mind that's just always trying to defend itself and prove itself, and that the less the small mind that gets hurt, And that's the one that talks to us, that loud voice in the head. And so that's there, and it's just like, that's why I can say now to have compassion for the unkind mind, because it can't really help it. It's just trying always to defend itself, curve itself, and it's just been hurt. It's just like someone, you know, an animal that's been abused, it'll strike out and try in fear and try to defend itself even if you're trying to help it, just because it has been hurt before and it doesn't trust. And that's how I see my mind is just sort of that sort of mind that's been hurt, so it's hurt to defend or hide or run. Is there anything else?
I can share. I mean, briefly, I that book, Radical Acceptance, was a real turning point for me too. Very, it spoke to me very strongly. I was a troubled teenager, very angry, and you know, I caused my parents a lot of pain. At least my family was my perception, and it wasn't. Unfactual that, you know, my family was angry with me. And, but to my mind, that was permanent. You know, that would never change. And, I felt effective and that I was on my own, you know, so I never asked my brothers for help or, you know, throughout my life. And, anyway, over the last 5 years, about 5 years ago, I got laid off from my job, so I couldn't be self-sufficient anymore. And I learned so much. My parents have been gone for many years, so I really needed my siblings, you know, and they were more than happy to come. I mean, they were waiting at my door for me to open it, you know, and my siblings really expressed a lot of, they were really pleased that I was, you know, reaching out to them. And, you know, losing my job was the best thing that ever happened to me, in one sense. You know, it was just sort of miraculous. So, Tara Brach, she really does a good job. And just, and Buddhism has, you know, really taught me that everyone is suffering. Everyone. You know, because I've been in the 12-step program for many years, and I was like, yeah, you know, 12-step people are unique in this way. And then I entered the world of Buddhism, and it's like, everyone suffers. Everyone, you know, is working against their own best self. And so it really, really opened my eyes to, you know, just the compassion in the world, and I stopped judging anyone or anything because, you know, we're all just operating the best we can with the skills that we have at the time, and you know, when we learn better skills, we do better. So, you know, Buddhism has changed my fundamental thinking, my fundamental operating. So, you know, right now I'm in a company and, you know, they just bought a bunch of companies, so there's more layoffs now. It's a whole different setup, but, you know, it's my job might be just as vulnerable as before, and I'm not terrified anymore. I'm not pleased about it. I need to do what I need to do, just like I've done before, but I can ask for help now, and other people have I have relationships with other people now, and I'm not so isolated, so thank you so much for sharing to me. I really appreciate what you have to say. Thanks
for coming. And when you brought up the help issue, that was one thing that I could notices I need help with everything, and so that it's a hard thing in this world to need help and to ask for help, and a lot of people really don't want to, even the small things, you know, ask for help. It like makes you feel like you're in this bottom position over someone else. And I've just been noticing that, and it's really interesting that that sort of just operates automatically, you know, this thing that I shouldn't ask for help. And for me, it's on a large scale. I need help with everything that I do. But just emotionally to notice that, you know, to ask for help is really helpful. Thank you. Hi, well, thank you for coming, everybody. Hope it helps.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.